Coming to you from the inflatable flamingo in Cleo's shower, it's The Liberal Arts.
A podcast about life and the things we would study if someone were paying us.
Please, somebody pay us.
Everyone, I'm Science.
I'm Cleo.
And I'm Rissa. Alright, I have two very important things to share with both of you. One of them is a very pertinent realization to the format of this podcast, which is that a couple months from now, I will be paid to study things.
Woohoo!
Which is
something we should be celebrating wildly.
I think so.
Yes.
Yeah, so I've got not yes. only an accepted to a PhD program, but funding, an RA ship for the first year and a TA ship for the following. So that's very
awesome.
Exciting.
Tell us, where and what will you be studying, my dear Rissa?
Yeah, so I'll be continuing my study in philosophy, in the philosophy of fiction, in interactive fictions. That's just a long way to say video games. I'll be doing it at the University of Georgia.
Nice.
Under Dr. Eris Meskin. But what I'll actually be paid for is developing an ethics program for some local high schools. So that's also exciting.
Oh, you're going to do such a good job.
Yeah. Yeah, I'll be working with the National Honor Society Ethics Bowl in Georgia. So that'll be
cool. Why are you so cool?
This is my kind of re-entry into academia after a gap year that turned into like a 4 or 5 year gap. I forgot how to math, so it's one of those two.
Same.
But the second very important piece of information was what I refused to share with you before we started the podcast proper. The students that I work with have told me that I have a catchphrase and have begun to repeat it in the classroom pretending to be me. And I'm very into it, and I think it says a lot about my personality and leadership style.
And
what is
this?
The catchphrase? We simply must
the
know.
The phrase is, well, don't do that. Because my students constantly inform me about their physical well-being in ways like, Miss, I have a headache. And I'm just, well, don't do that. They'll be like, it's just a constant state. Like, even if they're like, Miss, I'm bored, I'll be like, well, don't do that. I don't know what you want from me. Like, you're in high school now. Like, if you told me, Miss, I need a Band-Aid, I'm like, okay, I'll get you a Band-Aid. But if it's anything that I can't fix for you, anything that you're going to need to fix for yourself, whether it be attitude or anything else like that, I'm like, well, don't do that.
I love that so much.
So anyway, the kids have begun to say to each other, well, don't do that in my classroom, pretending to be me.
Yes.
I'm very into it. So yeah, that's
you
my...
know that's going to stick with them their whole lives,
yeah.
Right?
That's my thing. Like... if there's one thing I could pass on from my mother to them, it's the phrase, well, don't do that. I also... one of my students, I was from a Hispanic family, accused me of being... He actually burst out quite loud, you're a Hispanic mom! Because I said the phrase... I said the phrase, we have food at home. So, yeah, I apparently am just bringing such mom energy to this classroom, which isn't a thing I thought I had, but I do.
It's wonderful.
Apparently. One of the students actually made me a Mother's Day card this year because
the teacher
was trying to explain, we're going to make Mother's Day cards, and there's a couple kids here who don't live with their parents. So he said, your mother or whoever, like a woman who takes care of you. And he was very, like, someone at home in the outside school life who takes care of you and is also an woman. And one of the students was just like, you, like me, like said my name. And I laughed very loudly and explained why. No, at home, not me. She still insisted on making me a card. So, yeah,
that's
I am
adorable.
Now the first
so
of my
sweet.
Unwed friends to get a Mother's Day card unsolicited, which
congratulations.
Is not an achievement I thought I would have. See, anything about me.
That's a little, that's definitely on a higher level than what I achieved when I used to teach summer camp for, like, a Christian summer camp, mm-hmm. where my kids got very confused at the concept of spiritual family.
Oh, no.
And instead of, like, you know, we have our Father in heaven and we're all brothers and sisters, called me mom one day, and I was like, oh, you're being silly, I'm not your mom. And she looked at me very seriously and was like, you're my mommy in Christ.
No!
No!
And called me, and I was like, that's, you have the right idea. We are all a family. But that's not how that works.
Sorry, hey, Cleo?
Yeah.
Don't do that.
Don't do that. Don't do that. Yeah. The entire class spent the rest of the day at the pool screaming at me, mommy in heaven, and it was very awkward.
No, they did not.
That they is did.
Not sacrilegious.
Not sacrilegious at all.
Oh, no.
And I couldn't make them stop. Mainly because I was laughing too hard at the expression on all the other pool goers' faces.
You gotta love how, in education, you can really make a difference in kids' lives.
Really make a difference. Yeah, so no, the one thing, listener, if you are ever going to work in special education, or just in education in general, the one thing that you need to know is that these students will absolutely, unconditionally, one, believe anything you tell them, and two, repeat it. Just assume that anything you say is going to be repeated several times. So you gotta be careful. Like, the problem is I could tell them a joke, they would not know it was a joke, they would believe me, and then they would repeat it as a fact. So I have to be very careful about my use of things like sarcasm. It's a very dangerous position to be in.
Well, on that note, today we're glad to present to you Jurassic Park Part 2.
Woo!
Finally, what's it been, 3 months?
I mean, I'm sure it took them longer to make a Jurassic Park movie than it made you to analyze it, so you're still on the up and up.
Oh, listen, I've had all of these analyses running through my head for many, many years. You don't need to worry about my timing. I'm just thinking, it's been a minute since we've had a podcast.
That's fair.
In any case, do you want to finish up with good news or go into lecture?
Let's do the Jurassic Park now.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, so today's colloquium is part two of our Jurassic Park series, in which we talked about, like, the general overview of the series last time, like, rules of the series and common archetypes, and this time we're going to go through each of the films and see how those themes play out. And using my expert analysis, I will be predicting the plot, part of the plot anyway, of Jurassic World Dominion, which is coming out June 14th, 2022. What? I didn't know that off the top of my head. What are you talking about?
Hey, remind me, how many Jurassic Park films are there?
Including the one that is coming out next year, there will be 6.
Okay.
I all of the summaries will be brief. I've got them separated into easy-to-swallow chunks. We're not even going into the analyses of technology. We're touching on them. Anyway, to recap what we talked about last time. Mm-hmm. So, first of all, Jurassic Park, I do not consider them horror movies or creature features. I consider them to be thrillers. Point two, every Jurassic Park movie has particular elements in common, and they are thematically cohesive with each other. Point three, every Jurassic Park movie has children, and the children are the audience surrogate. Remember, the children are us, okay?
We are the children.
Point four. We are all children, in a way. Point four. Every Jurassic Park movie has scientists and tech people, and the way it treats scientists is a reflection of the way society thinks about scientists. The tech people land in, like, both good guys and bad guys, but they are never morally ambiguous. Likewise, tech can be used for evil and for good.
All right.
And then there are four key character archetypes in addition to the scientists and the children. That is the hunter, the capitalist, the idealist, and the martyr. There's also the lucky bag, but we won't be going into that. Okay, as we go through and we summarize these movies and think about them, we must remember the rules of Jurassic Park. Rule number one, the children are the audience surrogate and they never die.
Yay!
Yeah, exactly. That's why this is not a horror movie, because we are never really in danger. Rule number two, the dinosaurs are animals, not monsters, as established by this cool wide shot of them acting like animals in herds. That happens every movie. Rule number 3, the real danger is the velociraptors, no matter how scary the other animals are. And rule number 4, the Tyrannosaurus Rex always wins. Always.
I can see how this can make it kind of predictable. Not in a bad way, but in a, like, you are able to predict it. So I'm really looking forward to how that's gonna, which direction that's gonna go.
Oh, you don't even know. The way that these movies are structured has, like, thought and intention to it that I have never actually seen in any other series.
Huh.
And yes, I'm counting, like, the, you know, super-funded Ultra series that is the MCU, or, you know, Star Wars. Definitely Star Wars. It's intentional. It's all intentional. Okay, so, here we go. Jurassic Park, the original. Summary of the plot real quick. Millionaire John Hammond starts a scientific company, InGen, to clone dinosaurs from prehistoric DNA and make them a theme park. He gets pushback from sensible people telling him that this is a terrible idea, so he hires 3 scientists, Dr. Alan Grant, Dr. Ellie Sattler, and Dr. Ian Malcolm, to put their stamp of approval on the park. However, thanks to some corporate sabotage, the dinosaurs get loose, things break bad, many people die, and our heroes narrowly escape the island with their lives, having learned a valuable lesson. Right? I feel like most people already know this general plot line. So, Jurassic Park was made in 1993, based on a novel by Michael Crichton. It's got absolutely groundbreaking filmmaking, both now and at the time. It used a combination of practical and special effects that is rare in Hollywood, and in my personal opinion, has never really been matched. It is maybe pretty close to the perfect movie. It's definitely my favorite. So the argument of this film is you can't play God. Life is gonna find a way, and all the money in the world won't stop your lawyer from getting plucked off a toilet by a gorgeous 20-foot tall queen.
These are important life lessons to learn.
I mean, if you're gonna learn a life lesson, that's a pretty good one.
Very practical and useful lessons here. Only the best.
It's important to note that the lesson is not don't play God. It's you can't play God. It's a story about hubris, and therefore the conflict is man versus self. That'll become important later. So our cast of characters, the kids in this episode are Tim and Lex. They're John Hammond's grandchildren. Tim is a budding scientist. Lex is a hacker, so she's one of the quote-unquote good tech people. The ways Tim and Lex, we talked about this a little bit last time, how the kids are both the victims and the heroes of the story. The way that Tim and Lex are their heroes, they bamboozle 2 raptors, they stun one and lock the other in a freezer.
Arguably one of the most terrifying scenes in all of film.
Oh, yeah. Oh, absolutely. All of my nightmares come from that movie.
This is not okay.
The hunter in this movie is named Richard Muldoon. He is famous for his lines that are like, clever girl, and shoot her, and they should all be destroyed. The thing about the hunter is that they are a character with a lick of sense, and they have experience with wild animals that will kill you. Richard Muldoon is a sympathetic character, and he does die. He is torn apart by raptors right after saying, clever girl. So our capitalist in this one is the aforementioned lawyer who gets plucked off a toilet by a 20-foot tall queen, Donald Gennaro. He is decidedly non-sympathetic, and he dies. Most of the capitalists are non-sympathetic, although that changes in the Jurassic World series in some very interesting ways.
Because we live in a garbage society!
Right?
Sorry, what?
Who said that?
Sorry, was that me?
The idealist in this one is John Hammond, founder of the park. He is moderately sympathetic, but the thing about the idealist is that they never think of the consequences. It is all silver lining, there is no dark side of this cloud. Baby. Idealists usually live, so does John Hammond. He makes it through the movie. And then there is the martyr, Ray Arnold, played by Samuel L. Jackson. The Samuel L. Jackson. The inimitable Samuel L. Jackson. The martyrs are usually likable. They kind of have to be in order for their deaths to mean something. He is likable, even if he's not a particularly nice person. And of course he dies. Martyrs never live. That's why they're martyrs. Silly.
It is in the name.
I won't go through Jurassic Park original, the original one, even though most of us know about it, just so it can establish, like, the boundaries of the series as a whole, because it does a whole lot of groundwork in, you know, establishing the tropes that define the rest of the series. So we're just going to blow through to Jurassic Park, The Lost World. Jurassic Park, The Lost World. John Hammond calls up Ian Malcolm for a visit and lets him know good news. Jurassic Park had a second island site, and I'm turning it into a nature preserve. Also, your paleontologist
is
girlfriend.
Is that good news?
Right? Also, great, great further news. Your paleontologist girlfriend, Dr. Sarah Harding, is already there.
Wonderful news.
Isn't that awesome?
So good.
Yeah, Ian, of course, flips his lid and goes after her, only to find out that Hammond's been bamboozled by his terrible nephew, who wants to restart Jurassic Park in San Diego. This
Why?
Great idea is, of course... Yeah, no, terrible, right? This is, of course, followed by a rampaging T-Rex on the streets of California, which Ian and Sarah cleverly lure back onto a cargo ship and send back to the island, which does end up being basically a nature preserve. The Lost World was made in 1987 and loosely based on a novel, which Michael Crichton wrote specifically because Spielberg said, "Hey, Michael, I want to make another Jurassic Park movie. You should write another novel." And Michael's like,
"Wow,
sure, I love money."
Wait, is Sure I Love Money going to become like a repeating refrain of these stories? Because it kind of starting to sound like it.
Pretty much.
I mean, it is the repeating refrain of the capitalist, but I would not dare cast aspersions on Michael Crichton, particularly as being the capitalist. Specifically because he's a very good writer. I've read, actually, one of his other books, which is Timeline, which also has a movie based off of it that absolutely rules, and I think he would really like both of y'all. That having been said... Michael Crichton was like, "Sure, I guess." And then Spielberg looked at the book and said, "Well, this is okay, and I'm going to very loosely, base a novel off of it, or base a movie off of it." This movie had much more of the horror elements, especially the gore. I don't remember if Spielberg actually directed it, and I'm going to look that up real quick. Sorry!
Yeah, you do.
I know he was involved, but I don't think he was the director. Oh no, he did direct it. Look at that.
I do like that they didn't go the traditional direction and just name it Jurassic Park 2.
Well, sequel. It was because of the novel, you know.
Oh, right, of course.
Because the novel was not called Jurassic Park 2. It was called The Lost World.
Got you.
Yeah. Spielberg is nothing if not respectful to the source material.
Like, I will say, it's not a super, like, lost isn't really how I would describe this world.
It was much more lost in the book. Like, the second sight was a big secret.
Oh, all right.
And the fact was is that, okay, so this is a minor plot point in Jurassic Park, but the animals are designed genetically to have this deficiency of a certain amino acid, which, if they do not have, they will die, okay? But it turns out that some brain genius planted soybeans on the island, which, if they eat the soybeans, then they will gain back that immunity, and the carnivores eat the herbivores, and Sarah Harding goes into a whole thing in this movie about this and how amazing it is, because she is a good paleontologist.
Good for her.
Yes. If a little bit risk-takey. Anyway, so, the argument of this film, actually, is that these animals deserve respect. If you have the audacity to create life, you have the responsibility to protect it. It's just got a strong environmentalism theme, which was pretty common in the late 90s. And it's important to note this is a conflict with people who would exploit nature, not with nature itself. So the conflict is man versus man.
That makes sense.
Yes. Most environmental themes are not real. Like, stories with environmental themes are not real man versus nature stories, because it's usually not the people who are fighting nature who are, you know, demanding its protection.
Yeah, fair.
Although they can, you could make the argument that, oh, what's his name? He wrote the wolf ones, White Fang and stuff.
Oh, yeah.
Jack London. What's his name?
Thank you. Jack London, you could make the argument, was writing books with environmental themes that were man versus nature, and by man I often mean dog. I don't know. I don't know enough about Jack London to say these things with definitive, you know, confidence. Anyway, cast of characters in this particular movie. We already talked about the main characters, but in addition we have the kid, and her name is Kelly, and she is Ian Malcolm's daughter. She is a former gymnast who got kicked off the team and just really wants to spend time with her dad.
Aww.
She is also the only person in the entire franchise to kill a velociraptor.
Dang.
Yes, she did.
Wait, hold on. How? I've not seen the movie.
Yes.
She drop kicked it.
She used her gymnast skills. Didn't drop kick it, but kind of. She did kick it onto a spike, which impaled it, and it died.
Dang. All right.
Yes. She is also the first black person to live through a Jurassic Park movie. These movies are not perfect.
Yeah. Yay for her living, not for them not being perfect.
Right, yeah. Yay for her living, not for the racism in horror movies or horror-esque movies. The hunter in this one is named Roland Tembo. He is a British big game hunter. He's deliberately mimicking the style of Richard Muldoon in that he is like British and like very slick and looks like he lives out in the bush all the time. He is somehow sympathetic despite being hired by the capitalist because all he really wants is the joy of the hunt in a pure way that is not like tainted by the, you know, I love to kill animals kind of thing. It's like a more of a matching his wits against nature. So he ends up a little bit sympathetic, even though he, you know, he's hired by the capitalist to do evil things. He does live through the movie, but his best friend gets eaten by a raptor. So aww, that sucks.
I hate when the best friend has to suffer for this thing. Stories do that a lot.
I know, especially because the best friend was like his friend he made while hunting tigers in India and is also one of the only people of color in the movie who's named. Yeah, these movies are not perfect. The capitalist in this one is the The capitalist in this one is the aforementioned terrible nephew, Peter Ludlow. He is somehow more unsympathetic than freaking Gennaro, and he does die spectacularly at the hands of the Tyrannosaurus Rex he tried to ship to San Diego. He's frankly the worst. He reminds me a lot of the captain character in the second and third Pirates of the Caribbean movies. The guy from the tea company.
Oh, no.
Norrington. No, the guy from the tea company.
Beckett?
Norrington.
Beckett sounds right.
No.
Norrington's the governor. Never mind. It's been a while.
Norrington is the one Norrington that dies. Norrington is like my favorite character. Stop calling him that.
Yeah, the idealist in this movie is Nick Van Owen, who is an eco-terrorist. It's a little twist on the idealist. So, as all idealists do, this man sees protecting the animals as his top priority, even when it risks the safety of everyone around him. And it does. He was actually selected specifically by John Hammond because John Hammond suspected his terrible nephew of shenanigans. So he's like, okay, I'm going to hire an eco-terrorist just in case.
That works.
It's a little bit hilarious.
Yeah. He's not very sympathetic, but he does live. And our martyr in this one is... Yeah. He's fine. He's not a very sympathetic character. Reminds me a lot, actually, of a later scientist character that we will see, which is to say he's sympathetic to a very particular audience, but he is literally, you know, derided for his annoying qualities by other characters. It just so happens that these other characters are the bad guys.
Gotcha. Interesting.
Yeah, more on that in a minute. The martyr in this movie is Eddie Carr, Gadget Man. He is another good tech guy. He dies actively saving Sarah, Ian, and Nick from being dropped off a cliff in a truck. He gets eaten by not one but two Tyrannosaurs. It's very gory, kind of spectacular. That is the second movie. I think it's worth it specifically for the Tyrannosaurus Rex on the streets of San Diego sequence, which is pretty good, I think.
Mommy, there's a dinosaur in the backyard.
Exactly, that's the bit. Oh, it's so good. A dog does die, be advised, but, you know, sorry about that. Jurassic Park 3! So,
Is this one just called Jurassic Park 3? Like, they couldn't think of a name?
It is, in fact. it's Jurassic Park 3, but the 3 is 3 slash marks made by claws.
Okay, that's not the only lazy thing about
this movie, girl.
Oh no!
Okay, Jurassic Park 3. Dr. Alan Grant is trying desperately to fund his paleontology research in a world where there are literal actual dinosaurs living off the coast of South America. He is approached by a wealthy couple, the Kirbys, looking for a flyover view of the second island and a tour guide to lead them. Desperate to fund his dig, and impressed by the number of zeros on the check the Kirbys hand him, Alan says yes, brings along his student, Billy. But their plane actually lands on the island, and Alan discovers that not only are these people not wealthy or married, they're divorced, they're actually there to look for their son, who went missing on a trip with the lady's new boyfriend. Not only that, but there's a new thing lurking on the island, which we're going to talk about in a second.
What? No, you can't do that to me!
Yes, I can.
Rude.
Give me literally 4 minutes, babe. Oh my goodness.
I've never seen this movie before.
So, just to wrap up, in the 3 months since we recorded, Rissa still has not watched Jurassic Park.
Hey, it's okay.
Thank you.
So, these movies are no longer based on novels, and this is not a Spielberg movie. There's more CGI and gore than before. This movie had a much smaller budget, and there's a reason for the style of this film. The argument of this movie is the only way to survive nature is to realize that you are a part of it.
Oh.
It's got a very strong survivalism theme, and the primary conflict here is man versus nature. The man in question is a child, Eric Kirby.
Oh, no. This does not sound like a pleasant film.
Eric is the child who was lost on the island. He's a resourceful kid known for getting into trouble, but he lives. He survives everything. Raptors and tiny little compies. Piranha-like meat-eating compies.
No, thank you.
And there's a T-Rex.
And a pterodactyl.
The pterodactyls, but also the Spinosaurus. Spinosaurus.
None of this sounds fun.
Long, nasty jaw. It's not. More on the Spinosaurus in the sec. There's no hunter or capitalist in this movie. There's actually no professionals at all in this movie. Your idealist is Billy Brennan, student of Alan Grant. He's a grad student and an aspiring paleontologist who makes stupid mistakes for the love of his teacher and his trade. You know, no big deal. He just steals some velociraptor eggs.
Great job. No flaws.
He is the first... Yeah.
It's okay, though. He kept him in the lucky bag.
Yes, he did. The Return of the Lucky Bag, which was also in the second movie, blah, blah, blah. It doesn't matter. Why they did that exact same trope again in, like, almost the exact same way is beyond me, but what do I know? It's another lazy element of this movie. So, he's the first idealist to have what I would say is a near-death experience. I mean, idealists have been in danger before. I mean, they dangled Nick off of a cliff. But he is the first one that we think is dead. He does show up at the end. He's fine. But this is the first time that the idealist has been threatened in this way. And then the martyrs in this one are a little bit funky because, in theory, it's Udesky. Udesky is not a good guy. He is a liar. He says he is a mercenary. He is not really a mercenary. Hmm. He's just kind of a corporate matchmaker that finds mercenaries for people, and heck, there was an opening on this job, so he thought he'd tag along.
That sounds super safe.
It's... Nope. the mercenaries he brings along are Nash and Cooper. They're not good guys. They die almost immediately as soon as they land on the island. These martyrs are more like cannon fodder, honestly.
Yikes.
Yeah.
Somebody had to die on this island. It might as well be them. Despite this, Udesky is pretty sympathetic. Much like the Kirbys themselves, he is a fraud, presenting himself as something he is not because, you know, he is desperate at this time. And his sacrifice is a little more incidental than the other martyrs that we've had before, a little less deliberate, but he is nevertheless sacrificial. So, you may have guessed that this movie is a notable break from the series. So, Eric is the object of the plot. They go to the island to rescue Eric. And since children are the audience surrogate, Jurassic Park 3... is about us, which means,
ooh,
of all the movies, this one is the most horror-esque because it is about us. The creature of this creature feature is the Spinosaurus, and this is the second break from the series where it breaks its own rule. This is the only true breaking of one of the four rules, which is the Spinosaurus beats the T-Rex the moment that the two of them fight. It breaks the T-Rex's neck. It does this specifically to establish that you are in uncharted territory here. That while you might be able to hide from a T-Rex by not moving, you will have no such luck with the Spinosaur.
Terrifying.
It can smell you.
It can smell you. It can also see you.
Don't Spinosaurs eat, like, plants?
That's a Stegosaurus.
No, babe. Oh, no.
Oh. Okay.
Yeah, a Spinosaur is like an alligator on two T-Rex legs with a sail.
No, thank you. I thought we were talking about a Stegosaurus this entire time. It was going to be a really weird movie in my head.
Oh no. No. Oh no. Oh no, my dear Issa, no.
Well, you know, they're dinosaurs. They got spines. I don't know. Look, most of my education about dinosaurs has come from either you or Miss Frizzle. Those are my two places I get dinosaur facts from.
I'm so honored. Thank you. This movie is also a break from tradition because there are no tech people at all except arguably Udesky. He's kind of a gadget guy. This movie is less about the dangers of technology and more about living with the world that you have created.
Nice.
Okay. Everyone take a breath. It's been 14 years, and what comes out in theaters? Jurassic World.
I saw that one.
It starts out trying to market itself as a whole new world. Things are different this time. One, the park is up and running and successful. Nobody's getting eaten. There are thousands of tourists every day. The other is the raptors are trained. They respond to a clicker, like dolphins. The most dangerous animal in the whole park is trained. The T-Rex is behind glass and a sideshow. She's not even visible. The first shot we have of a T-Rex is, like, through a crowd. The children are trying to look at it, eating a goat, and they can't see anything. And then this leads into the conceit of the film, which is stated by one of our protagonists. No one's impressed by a dinosaur anymore.
Aww.
See, it's all intentional.
It's very self-aware.
It is. Oh, very much so. Very much so. Since no one is impressed by a dinosaur anymore, Claire Deering, high-powered executive, tells the scientific team to make a new, really cool dinosaur, the Indominus Rex. This monstrosity can camouflage. It's as smart as a raptor. It's stronger than a T-Rex.
Bad.
It's also bad-tempered, unsocialized, and kills for sport.
No, thank you.
And of course it breaks out of its cage. Yes, havoc is wreaked, lots of people die, once again Jurassic World is abandoned to its animals. So this movie is really clever in the way it was marketed because it marketed itself as a whole new thing, but it's really a sequel. It did a really good job of setting us up for, you know, no, all your expectations are wrong. Things are different now, which is exactly the thing that the main characters are arguing. It's like, Jurassic World is fine. It's safe. Things are different now. They're not different. They're not different.
They're worse.
Yeah. There are no recurring characters in this movie, but there are lots of Easter eggs. The lucky bag shows up again. Very briefly, but it does, you know, save a child's life.
And that's really, what else could you ask?
Really? And what's interesting about this, the argument of this movie is that it ends up being the same as the first movie. You can't play God. Living things are not marketing schemes. You can't create a monster and treat it like a monster and expect it not to act like a monster.
So Frankenstein.
Despite its initial... Oh, yeah. Oh, very much so.
Yeah.
It's all about the hubris, baby.
I need a Jurassic Park t-shirt that just has the logo and the words, "It's all about the hubris, baby," underneath.
I would buy that shirt.
I would buy it.
I would wear it. Okay, sorry. Continue.
No, there's no worries. despite its initial introductions of being like a bigger, better Jurassic Park, Jurassic World supports its own argument that life finds a way by falling back onto the rules. So, one convincing conversation between the Indominus Rex and the Velociraptors, and the Velociraptors quit being domesticated. They throw off their chains. They're like, you know what? Screw it, Grady. We don't like you anyway. We're gonna follow the Indominus Rex. She's our new awesome friend.
She has
not
a cooler
you,
name
Owen,
than you.
Grady. Exactly. So, which makes the Velociraptors once again the most dangerous animal in the park. And in the end, they eventually fall back and help Owen Grady, because he did raise them from babies. So there is, like, an emotional connection there. But right when it's looking like they're fighting the Indominus Rex and the Indominus Rex will win, who will tip the scales but your queen and mine, the Tyrannosaurus Rex.
Yay.
And guess what? She always wins!
She always wins.
Yeah, so it falls back on the rules. Following those rules means that it ends up subverting the themes of the original series and then falling back into them in a very satisfying way. It would be a great movie if it was just a little better written.
That's, you know, that's a very, very applicable sentence to many movies.
But the ending,
isn't that the case? A lot.
The ending of that one in particular, like you said, is very satisfying for how it falls back on the original tropes and things.
Mm-hmm, definitely. I thought so. It knows what people are actually there to see.
It was poorly written, but
they don't want a bigger, better, badder dinosaur. Yeah. It hits the right emotional tenor, for sure. Yeah. So the kids in this movie are Zach and Gray. They are Claire Deering's nephews. Gray is a genius child who is very excited about dinosaurs. Zach is our first child who is a teenager. He is bored. He doesn't want to be there. The teenager thing seems like a departure, but it is not, because remember, the kids are us. And if you're like me, you have seen a dinosaur in a movie before. So Zach is representative of our skepticism, as much as Gray is representative of our excitement. We can see ourselves through both of these kids. Zach and Gray manage to escape the Indominus Rex, and they manage to zap a Velociraptor through the power of teamwork. They also would have been really good characters if they'd been slightly better written.
Seems like a reoccurring theme at this point.
Yeah. The way that this movie treats scientists is also a departure from the original. So the most scientist in this movie is Henry Wu, who showed up in the original movie as sort of just like a side character, who like was neither a bad guy or a good guy. He just showed up to explain the science in the laboratory. In this movie, he is the essence of morally gray. He is in it for the profit. He absolutely has some kind of morally dubious side gig that someone refers to. He's also the first scientist who is not presented as instantly trustworthy, which is, I think, indicative of the way that we treat scientists now, because you can look up anything on the internet. So, like, scientific expertise isn't treated as mystical and unreachable anymore. It's treated as, like, fairly accessible and, in some cases, something to be suspicious of.
Interesting.
This is not the only departure in archetype, though. The hunter in this movie is Owen Grady, played by one of the,
the guy.
One of the Chris's.
We know who he is.
One of the Chris's.
Chris,
one of those Chris's.
One of the... Chris Pratt. There we go. He is also... Owen Grady is also technically a scientist. He is an animal behavior expert. We see his field notes in the next movie. But he does not fall into a scientist trope by any means. He is more like the hunter. He is the only character with a lick of sense. He is used to wild animals who will kill. He's also the first hunter who is a main character. He takes that familiar archetype and moves it into protagonist land.
Huh.
He's pretty sympathetic at the beginning. As a main character, he undergoes some character development to become more so, and he does live because he's a protagonist. The capitalist in this movie is also a departure because it is Claire Deering. She is the first capitalist who is a woman. She is also a main character. And again, she is very unlikable at the beginning. She blows off her nephews for profit. She blows off her ethics for profit. She blows off, like, treating the animals well for profit. But she undergoes character development that makes her sympathetic. She's a whole different person in the next movie. But in a way that's, like, thematically cohesive. I think it was true to her character development. I don't think it was, like, out of character for her. She becomes sympathetic over time. She is the first capitalist to live. She's also the first capitalist to have an ounce of sympathy directed at her.
That's an interesting change. Sorry.
Oh, isn't it, though? The idealist in this movie is Simon Masrani. He is the first idealist who is a person of color. He is a dear friend of John Hammond and definitely meant to be a John Hammond analog. He is, he actually, like, at one point asks Claire, but are the animals happy? He really does care about the well-being of the animals and the park. He just does not recognize that what he's doing is incredibly dangerous for many, many people. He's also the first idealist who dies. He dies because he is disabused of his idealism, and he realizes that the only chance he has to stop the Indominus Rex, which he definitely contributed to existing, is to try and crash a helicopter into it.
Good grief.
So he dies in a very martyr-like manner. He is very sympathetic.
Wait, is he not considered the martyr, though?
No, he's not the martyr, because the martyr is someone else. The idealist usually stops being an idealist because they are disabused of their idealistic notions. The previous time the idealist nearly died was Billy Brennan, okay? So mm-hmm. he nearly died when he disabused of the notion... Okay, so he stole the Velociraptor eggs.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Alan Grant, in some really honestly quite terrible writing, tells him that for putting the ideas about money and profit and saving the dig before the safety of the people around him, he is no better than the people who built this place. Billy takes that to heart. He is disabused of his idealistic notions, and he saves Eric by diving into a very dangerous situation. He makes the conscious effort to do something selfless,
mm-hmm.
Because, you know, his idealism has been, you know, he's been disillusioned of his idealism. John Hammond undergoes similar character development, although he doesn't do anything particularly martyr-like. Nick Van Owen would absolutely dive into danger. He would, if his friends were in danger, he would probably dive into danger. That's not a situation the movie ever puts him in. So this isn't out of character for the idealist to be disabused of their notions and try and do something to make up for it in a selfless way.
Nice. Okay.
The fact that he's a person of color and also the first idealist who dies... I wish
not
that it
great.
Was a coincidence, but it's just, it keeps happening. The martyr in this one is actually Zara Young. She's the first martyr who has absolutely no tech or gadgetry experience. She is a woman also. And yet, she is also the first martyr who is not very sympathetic, because she is the hardworking assistant of Claire Deering, who is made to be a babysitter and is not really pleased about it.
Oh, her.
The odd... Yeah.
Sorry. I just, I was having a
Morgana.
Big trouble. Yeah. Got you.
Oh, yeah. Because she is there to babysit the audience surrogate and the audience surrogate ditch her, we are not inclined to think kindly of her. I stand by the fact that Zara Young did nothing wrong. However, she does die trying to save the boys in a spectacular manner. I believe she's eaten by 2 or 3 dinosaurs in a row.
Good grief.
Oh, gosh. Yeah. In concept, Jurassic World is a good movie. It's just that it's, like, not very well written. I wish the dialogue was better. That's mostly it. I wish that they had found a way to let Simon Masrani live, but they probably would have had to bring him back for the next movie. Speaking of the next movie... Okay, Movie 5, Jurassic World Fallen Kingdom, arguably the most buck-wild movie of the series, and we are talking about one that put a T-Rex in San Diego. Fallen Kingdom goes like this. A volcano is gonna kill all the dinosaurs.
Okay.
Again.
Yeah. Not again, actually. The volcano has never happened. The island is going to be destroyed by a volcanic eruption. And since this is the only place dinosaurs live, all of the dinosaurs are going to die.
Unless...
I have a question.
You don't have to apologize.
Unless the rest of the movie.
Unless the rest of the movie. Yes, Cleo?
So, at the end of Jurassic Park 3, the slash marks, mm-hmm. one of the big plot points in that is that they release a cage of pterodactyls.
Yes,
and those pterodactyls,
more on that in a minute.
Are let loose on the world, so...
Oh, I know. Yeah. Mm-hmm. We'll get there in a sec. meanwhile, a volcano is going to kill all the dinosaurs. The island is going to be destroyed. Benjamin Lockwood, who was John Hammond's business partner way back before the park even was built, before they even nailed down the whole dinosaur thing, has a plan to move all the dinosaurs to a new island with the help of his underling, Eli Mills.
Sounds a lot like John Hammond's plan from the second movie, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Unfortunately, in a move reminiscent of a certain terrible nephew, Eli Mills has a different idea. Auction the dinosaurs off as weapons in the basement of the Lockwood Mansion.
What? Where did that come from?
And, you know, while we're auctioning things off, we might as well include Henry Wu's newest abomination, the Indoraptor.
Maybe
that's right.
What if we didn't, actually?
It's a new twist on the Indominus Rex. The Indoraptor is a living weapon built with Owen's raptor research that follows a laser and will kill everything on sight and on command. Or not on command. Just in general, it will kill everything. You can imagine how well this whole plan goes. Yes. And it's a raptor that was, again, never socialized. It's a monster. It was built like a monster. It was treated like a monster. Of course it's going to be a monster. Okay, the scientist in this one, Henry Wu, shows up again, being very fussy about his dinosaurs that he created, especially the Indoraptor. But we also have another scientist, Zia Rodriguez, a paleozoologist who has never seen a dinosaur.
I'm sorry.
She studied this academically.
They've been around for a while now, so get on that.
Okay, but she's a grad student and she's poor.
Oh, fair. We've all been there.
She's a millennial with no money. She can't just fly to an island that's literally off limits from the government.
That's fair. I just meant, you know, I meant that it was a theme park for a while, so.
It was an expensive theme park, though, is the thing.
Fair.
And at that point, she would have been probably in early college, based on the timeline of the movie.
Fair. Okay. I'm back on board.
So, yeah. Unlike previous scientists introduced in the series, she is not instantly trustworthy, but unlike Owen Grady, she is much more of a true scientist, what comes to mind when you think of a scientist. She is like Nick Van Owen, the eco-terrorist, in that she is sympathetic to certain audiences, but she is literally also called a nasty woman. She's just mean. She's kind of mean.
Yikes.
Yeah, it's not bad, though. Like, I personally like her. I know a lot of audiences don't, but she's not made for those audiences. She's made to be sympathetic to me.
She was made for you!
Much like Nick Van Owen.
Sorry. That just got funny to me.
So, our main characters in this one are still Clara Deering and Owen Grady, but they've moved from being archetypes to much more, you know, quote-unquote normal kinds of characters. So, Owen Grady has given up the animal behaviorism and is a blue-collar guy, and Clara Deering has gone from capitalist to environmental activist, calling Congress people all the time. That's right, Claire is almost the idealist. Almost. Not quite. There's a plot reason for that. So, our idealist is actually Benjamin Lockwood. He trusts the vision of John Hammond, as well as the people who work for him. It's referenced that they had some big fight back before they'd ever created a dinosaur, and that's why they split ways. But he still has love and trust for his old friend. He is a very sympathetic character. He's very likable. He dies. He is murdered.
Oh.
He can't do much about it.
So the idealists just keep dying once they start, is what I'm hearing.
Yes, very much so, yeah. He has a big secret that characterizes him as the idealist. You know, it's not just, I want to save the animals. It's that he holds certain convictions as very important to him, and he's not willing to compromise them even when he should be thinking about the consequences. More on that in a sec.
Gotcha.
The capitalist in this one is Eli Mills, terrible underling. He is the first capitalist who's a literal murderer. He kills Ben Lockwood. He smothers him with a pillow.
Yikes.
Yeah. He's wildly unsympathetic, and of course he dies. The hunter in this one is Ken Wheatley. He's the first truly unsympathetic hunter. He's a big game hunter who likes collecting dinosaur teeth as trophies. He has slightly less than a lick of sense because this is how he is killed. He does that to the Indoraptor. The Indoraptor does not take kindly to this. And then the martyr in this installment, I guess, is Iris. She's a sort of answer to the previous martyr, Zara, from the last movie. She is another caretaker. You know, her job is to take care of the kid, but she is willing and loving, and she actually dies protecting the child, Maisie. Iris is much more of a true martyr than Zara is. It's sad, but, like, unlike Zara, her sacrifice is, you know, worthy of the audience's grief, because the child cares about Iris. You know, that's her nanny. Speaking of the child is Maisie Lockwood. She is Benjamin Lockwood's quote-unquote granddaughter.
What's with the quote there, friend?
You'll see. She loves adventures and dinosaurs. She's the first child not to fight or defeat dinosaurs, especially velociraptors. And the reason for that is because, what was it? Oh, yeah, she's a gosh dang clone.
I'm sorry. Come again.
She is or has?
She is a clone. She is a clone of Lockwood's daughter, who was killed in a car wreck. And Benjamin Lockwood said, I will clone my daughter and have another. And John Hammond said, that is a gross abuse of our power. And Benjamin Lockwood said, I do not care.
Which is
why Benjamin Lockwood is the idealist. They've
had this
ability
the whole time. I hate this.
I mean, that's kind of why she's a big secret. The only people who know about this are Ben Lockwood and Iris. I believe later Eli and Maisie figure it out. I know Maisie figures it out. So throughout the movie, she is visually conflated with the dinosaurs, associated with them in multiple ways. There's this shot of her face, and it's the reflection of her face in a pane of glass, and through that reflection you can just barely see the Indoraptor. I mean, like, the film cinematography wants us to associate her with the dinosaurs. And since the children are audience surrogates, the movie wants us to associate ourselves with the dinosaurs.
Okay.
Interesting.
So that leads to the argument of this movie. In the final scene, because of a lab accident, the dinosaurs, which are trapped in cages under the Lockwood Mansion, are about to all get poison gassed to death. Claire has the option. Oh, yeah. Claire has the option. This is after the Indoraptor has been killed, and has been defeated. The only question left in the movie is, what do we do with all these dinosaurs in the basement? And the answer seems to be, let them die, or release them out into the wild, into the forests of Northern California, creating absolute ecological chaos. So, Claire has spent the whole movie trying to preserve these dinosaurs' lives at any cost, idealist style, but in this moment, she chooses not to let them go. Unlike all of the other idealists, she is thinking about the consequences, and she's doing this without being disabused of her idealism, which is why she's not really the idealist. She makes the decision, she turns away, it's hard for her, she cares very deeply about these animals, and then Maisie pushes the button. Maisie lets them go out into the wild, because after all, they're like her. So, Maisie is the audience surrogate. Yeah, if she is empathizing with the dinosaurs, we are meant to think this way as well. So, the argument of this movie is, these animals deserve respect and empathy. They are alive because of you, and they're not all that different from you anyway.
Dang.
Interesting.
Yeah,
so
it's a conflict of humans preserving life versus humans exploiting it, so it's another man versus man conflict. Yes, question from the audience.
I still, because I have spent a large majority of my life believing that after the end of the third one, there have been colonies of wild pterodactyls. Are you telling me that's not the case in this universe? Not in real life.
It's never brought to fruition.
I mean, that's just a complete waste of the plot line.
It's just a drop ball right there.
It really is, honestly. To be fair, Jurassic Park 3 is not that good of a movie.
But I love it. And I wanted a colony of wild pterodactyls.
I have to say, science, this was a lot, but a very interesting, like, first look into some of these movies for me. I've seen exactly two of these movies, and not even sequential. So this has been very interesting. Mm-hmm.
So glad. Would you like to talk about, would you like me to predict the plot of a movie none of us have seen?
Yes,
please.
Write me a movie.
Okay. So, Jurassic World Dominion is coming out, I said June 14th earlier, but it is June 10th, 2022. What we know about the film is that it is bringing back the original three scientists, so Dr. Alan Grant, Dr. Ian Malcolm, Dr. Ellie Sattler. Yeah, dang. Ian Malcolm was back for a short cameo. He was testifying before Congress, but he's not had a major plot involvement. They're also bringing back Owen and Claire, Zia Rodriguez, and Franklin Webb. Good tech. Owen and Claire? Yeah. Oh, wait. Oh, the original three scientists?
No, well, I don't know. Oh, wait. No, sorry. Okay, I got it mixed up. I thought for some reason my brain was thinking that you meant they were bringing back the original kids from the first one and they were adults now.
That would be good.
Oh, that's Lex and Tim. Yeah, no. Owen and Claire are, that's Chris Pratt and...
Got you. Thank
what's
you.
Her face?
Yeah. The redhead.
You're welcome. They're also bringing back Zia Rodriguez, the scientist, and Franklin Webb, good tech lad, who rescued Zia by stabbing Henry Wu in the neck with a sedative.
Okay.
He's kind of awesome. Yes. So there's also the press releases that I have seen said that there will be no new dinosaurs. They're not going to make an Indoraptor for this or anything.
Thank God.
And that the major plot point is that the dinosaurs are on the loose.
Yes.
Finally, okay. Dealing with our consequences.
I shouldn't be excited about that, right? But I am.
The tiger is out. Yes.
Yes, it is free.
Okay, so here's what we've seen so far. Jurassic Park is a man versus self conflict with the moral you can't play God. Mm-hmm. Jurassic World was a man versus self conflict with the moral you can't play God. Mm-hmm. Jurassic Park 2, The Lost World, was a man versus man conflict with the moral these animals deserve respect and strong environmental themes. Jurassic World 2, Fallen Kingdom, was a man versus man conflict with the moral these animals deserve respect and strong environmental themes. Mm-hmm. Jurassic Park 3, with three slash marks, was a man versus nature conflict with survivalism themes, and the moral, the only way to survive nature is to realize you are a part of it. Therefore, I predict that Jurassic World Dominion will be a man versus nature conflict with survivalism themes, and the moral, the only way to survive nature is to realize you are a part of it.
If Owen Grady does not ride a velociraptor in this movie, I'm suing.
Their bone structure is not strong enough to hold the muscle man.
Has that ever stopped Hollywood?
Considering that the velociraptors in these movies aren't actually velociraptors, why should that stop us?
Counterpoint. Someone needs to ride the T-Rex.
Yes.
Okay, sorry. That would you actually, said survivalism themes, so cool. Probably not that, but still.
Okay, but it's okay.
I feel like she would take kindly to that.
What I was gonna say earlier is that it's interesting to me what you have with these themes. What you said is that especially Jurassic Park 3 with the slash marks, the whole theme is that we have to learn to live with what we've created. Mm-hmm. And when you get to Jurassic World, you have everyone relearning these lessons again. You can't manipulate life any way you want it. You can't play God, except for one person who's actually done the work to learn how to live with the nature we've created, and that's Owen. And that's why he survives at the end, because he's learned how to live with the velociraptors, and they save his life.
All right.
I think that that's a very interesting theme. I would be interested if that's brought to fruition.
Yeah.
Although it's important to note, he did not learn to live with the velociraptors. He That's helped to modify their genetics to make them more docile and cooperative.
True, but he also learned how to in a way become a part of the pack. So it's there, okay? He's gonna ride one or a T-Rex, either way. And that's how the world is gonna go forward. I don't know.
Just for that, I hope he gets eaten.
It's gonna be about people and dinosaurs living in harmony.
Well, that's the thing. Okay, so here are my predictions for this movie. It has not been confirmed by press release yet, but I do believe that Maisie will be the first recurring child character. Tim and Lex did show up with a brief cameo in the second movie, but like I think that she'll be the first recurring child character who is
She's the clone, our audience surrogate.
Yes, she is the clone. She was with Owen and Claire at the end of Fallen Kingdom, seeing as all of her legal guardians were dead.
Dead.
Fair. So, as a clone, I think that she's too plot important to disappear, so she'll stick with them. I do predict that this will be a survival story primarily, possibly with strong horror themes, much like Jurassic Park with three slash marks. This has kind of already been reflected in the Jurassic Park short, which is called Battle at Big Rock, which is on YouTube. Go watch it. It's great. There's a child with a crossbow.
Nice.
I think that, you know, the idea of this film will be, this is the dinosaurs' world now, we just live in it. Much like the third Jurassic Park movie. I like the idea. I think, like the third Jurassic Park movie, there will be no capitalist or hunter in this movie. There's not really a role for them to fill in a survivalism sort of a theme, because, you know, the hunter is an expert and the capitalist has to be exploiting this, and, like, there's not really room for either of those in a survival horror-esque story. My best bet for idealist is Claire, but I also predict that she will be the first idealist who is actually right in her idealism, because my prediction for the theme of this movie is we are going to have to find a way to live with the dinosaurs. And this is actually where the pterosaurs flying out to new lands comes into effect here, because at the end of Jurassic Park 3, Dr. Grant watches as some beautiful pterosaurs fly away to the island, and Eric asks, where are they going? And Dr. Alan Grant says something optimistic, despite the fact that they were trying to eviscerate him, like, hours ago. This plot point is never brought to fruition, as you pointed out, Cleo.
It's a whole new world out there for them.
There it is.
I did not watch that movie too many times as a kid. It's fine.
Oh, you're so valid. So, as you pointed out, this plot point is never brought to fruition, but I think it's a hint that in this movie, we will have to either live in harmony or die. So, harmony or death. That's your choices. I also predict we haven't seen the last of Henry Wu. Franklin hit him with a sedative in the last movie, but he's probably not dead.
Boo.
I also think that, like Jurassic Park 3, Dominion will end in a deus ex machina. I'm pretty sure about that one, just because that's exactly how Jurassic Park 3 ended, with the Marines rolling up on the beach, thanks to Dr. Ellie Sattler the best. I think the deus ex machina will have something to do with Maisie. She is plot important. But what I'd like most of all, and this is purely speculative, is I want for it to also involve Tim and Lex, the first children, because, it would be, you know, them bringing back more characters from the first movie, which they've already tried to do. B, it would be a nice addition to the moral, alongside the survivalism theme, if the audience surrogate saved the audience surrogate. Like, the idea of it is time for us to save ourselves.
Ooh, that's good.
And that's my prediction.
I like that a lot. Yeah.
And that's all I got. That's the end. Whew! Oh, boy, I'm beat. What was your question?
This might be unfair. But as this is a parallel to the third movie with the three slash marks, I need you to predict. Will this be a good movie?
Almost certainly not.
Yes! The best answer you could have given! Thank you. Thank you.
Look, I don't really consider any of the Jurassic World movies to be good movies. I just think they are thematically cohesive in interesting ways, and I like them. That's it.
Wonderful. Wonderful. Thank you. Thank you for that.
Guys, what if we had Dr. Alan Grant and Owen Grady riding on a pair of T-Rexes that step on Henry Wu?
Considering there's only one T-Rex left, I don't think that that's possible.
They could ride it together.
But I do like the idea of them stepping on Dr. Henry Wu. Hold on.
If there's only one T-Rex left, is she gonna die? Like, she can't have babies.
I don't know. It kind of depends on how harmony or death works out. Like, are they gonna?
I'm sorry, science. This was your that was your cue. That was your the perfect time when you could have said, "Life finds a way." You've missed it. You've missed your cue. I'm sorry.
If I am anyone in this movie, I am certainly not Ian Malcolm.
Come on. It's the one quote from Jurassic Park I actually know.
I'm trying to remember at this point. No, Dr. Wu doesn't die. The person I'm thinking of who gets stomped on by, stampeded by animals is in fact Eli Mills, terrible capitalist boy. Anyway, sorry. That's not relevant. Nat can cut that. It's fine.
I was gonna say, these movies are taking Eat the Rich to a whole new level. You can cut that too, Nat.
Yeah. No, leave that.
Do not cut that.
Eat the Rich.
So that's my colloquium.
This is why we need dinosaurs.
Thank you for listening.
Eat the Rich.
This is a very bad idea. Please. Do not start cloning dinosaurs to eat the rich.
There are many ways we can eat the rich. We don't need to play God to do it.
Don't eat people. That's fair. I don't care if they're rich. Don't eat them. That's cannibalism.
That's the real moral here. Don't eat people. Oh, gosh. Okay. So I hear Cleo, that you have some good news for us.
I do. Been scouring the news for good and interesting stories, and it's amazing how hard it is to make those two things combine. But I have done it, and so I come to you today bearing good news from the Indigenous Nations of North America and their fight against COVID. So I think we can agree, if any people on this continent know the consequence of disease run rampant and what that can do to a society, it would be them. And so they have been working very hard to protect their citizens from the coronavirus. And I was reading an article recently about the Blackfoot Confederacy and their reservations in Montana. So science, you'll find this interesting because it's in Montana.
I've actually driven through that area.
They have managed to vaccinate over 95% of all eligible people on their reservations in Montana.
Dang.
Yes!
Yes. And in fact, they had a surplus of vaccines, so they called their Confederate tribes across the border in Canada and had a cross-border vaccine clinic and gave out 1,000 vaccines to people across the border in Canada, which is a big deal just for Canada in general, because they've had a really hard time getting a hold of the vaccine. I think at the time this article was written, the 1st of May, only 3% of Canadians in total have been able to get it. So people drove for about, 5 hours to come and line up for this. So that was a pretty big deal for them.
That's fantastic.
Way
to
go.
For reference, a fun science fact, we consider it reaching herd immunity when 80% of people have been vaccinated. So that's incredible.
Yes.
Yeah.
So.
Wow.
That's such good news.
That is. That's awesome.
Alongside that, the Navajo Nation has, as of May 12th, which was last week, over 90% of people within their tribal lands had received at least one dose of the vaccine, and 41% had both.
Yay!
So,
Nice.
Yes, the Navajo Nation has also added, I think I read, due to having to update their records in order to receive more federal funding during this, they realized that they actually had 93,000 more people than they thought they did. Dang. And they are now have the largest population of any recognized Native nation in the United States. So almost 400,000 people. So yay for them.
Dang,
They also had a 70% I just started Googling weird numbers about the Navajo Nation. 76% voter turnout in Arizona in the 2020 election. For context, the state that had the highest turnout, I think, was Minnesota at about 80%.
Dang.
So they're just kicking butt and taking names over there in the Navajo Nation. Way to go, guys.
Great work, y'all.
Way to be. So.
Oh, what excellent good news.
Yes.
If you have good news to share with us, or you have thoughts about your favorite and least favorite dinosaurs, we would love to hear from you. You can always email us at theliberalarts@gmail.com or follow us on our social medias. Links in the description. Thank you to, the folks that we always thank.
The folks.
The folks. Thank you to Tristan from Vintage Lab Tech for our theme song. and for to Caitlin Thompson for our graphics and design, and also for to Nat Bree, who is editing this episode for us. Thank you, Nat.
Yay, Nat. We love you.
We do. And we're when you sorry. Hear us yelling at Nat, we're so sorry.
This is the first episode and she'll be editing, and already we know she's a saint in human form, so.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. Alright, until next time, everybody, learn something worth knowing.
Don't eat people.
Don't eat people. That's worth knowing.